Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What's happening? It's Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome. Welcome to it. Welcome back. Hey, it's you again. What's happening? I am, as you can tell, perhaps, maybe you can, hear the difference. I am doing this from, what do we call it? I'm on the road. I've got my Zoom rig and my Beta 58s and my little cords, and I'm in a hotel room in Boulder, Colorado. I'm recording this on Sunday before the Monday that most of you will hear this. Maybe the people in the next room will hear it before you, perhaps the people in the hallway. I heard some of them out there. I don't know. It seems okay. Sound seems okay. Today on the show, I talked to Rob Lowe. He came by the new situation over at the house. Came upstairs, walked past the bedrooms into the back second bedroom there, and we tucked in and did the thing. He was actually the first person that I interviewed in that environment, and I think it went pretty well. Pretty together fella, that Rob Lowe. Good talk. Nice to meet him. Yeah, solid dude. But I was in Aspen, and if you were following my story and my panic and my apprehension about my shows in Aspen, I can tell you it turned out better than anticipated. And I learned some things, too. I learned that the fears that I talked about on the last show were there. Certainly the PTSD from several sort of strained, difficult shows over the years at the Aspen Comedy Festival. But I actually realized it went deeper. It went deeper, and I think I might have touched on this a little bit, but the PTSD from my childhood and ski vacations with my family, I think, was more at the core of it. And I didn't realize that until driving in. Just the only time my family would really get together and spend any time together for any period of time was on those ski vacations. And we didn't know each other that well. We were all in the same house, but, kind of self-absorbed into our own thing. And when we all got together in the car, it could get pretty gnarly. Yeah, we'd listen to fun music. My dad had 8-tracks. He had Hocus Pocus. He had Abbey Road. He had the soundtrack of American Graffiti. He had Buddy Holly's greatest hits. That was all pretty good. But when it really got down to it, in a hotel room, 4 people don't know each other that well, a couple of younger people that really have to defer to the older people who are also nuts and selfish, it could get a little ugly. And I think I had forgotten just how bad those vacations were. Most of the days were ruined around a glove, or perhaps a hat, or why didn't we bring those socks that I like? My dad would go crazy over things like that, and usually before the ski day started, at least one of us was crying, whether it be my mother, my brother, or me. Maybe all of us were crying, and then he'd find the socks, or he'd find the hat, or he'd get past it, and we'd hit the slopes. But not great memories. I do remember one ski trip where, my brother wasn't on it for some reason, and it was me and my mother and father, and I declared that I wish they were more like my friend Eric's parents, and then my dad yelled, maybe you should go fucking live with Eric, and then my mom was crying, my dad was crying, I was crying, and I'm not sure that ever resolved itself, now that I think about it, but that was a ski trip. But I'm okay. I got to Aspen, and I eventually, made my way into town, walked around, and realized what a ridiculous fantasy land it is. Just the class strata of Aspen is kind of, I wouldn't say disturbing, but extreme. I mean, you literally have some of the richest people in the world that have houses there that they visit maybe 6 days a year. So they're around, and then you have some of the richest people in the world who go there to ski, and then you have locals, and then you have, kind of normal people that go there to ski. But the business, it is reasonably priced, is not something that you hear in Aspen very much. It's like $9 for a Cliff Bar. Everything you buy, even if it's breakfast, is $20. Again, not cheap, just noticing things. Oh, here's the other thing. I actually was walking down the street in Aspen. There was just a guy sitting in front of an office on the main street there where the bricked in area is. And I walked by him, and as I'm walking by, he goes, "You want to buy a house?" He said that he was a real estate agent on the street, like a drug dealer. And I turned to him and I said, "Is that really an impulse buy?" And he goes, "Hey, sometimes it's an emotional moment. You never know. It might happen." And I'm like, "Yeah, I don't have my checkbook, pal. Thanks for the offer. I wish you the best. I hope you sell a house here on the street this afternoon." But the show, turns out, it was good. It was pretty fucking good, folks. It was, I'd forgotten, as I always do, that however I freak myself out, once I get the sound check and I stand on that stage in whatever theater it is, part of me's like, "Oh, yeah, of course this is what I do. This is where I live. This is it. There was some good press on me in Aspen. I mean, a guy for the Aspen Times. Actually, things have been written about me here and there, but this guy kind of did a good job. He did a good job. This guy, Andrew Travers. I talked to him, and I was on the cover of the weekend section, and in Aspen, 19 people live there, so it actually means something. And the article was good, but they told me it was a big walk-up crowd in the Wheeler Opera House where I was performing, which I had performed in before, different incarnations of myself over the years at the festivals. It's a beautiful little old theater built in the 1800s. It's got about 400 seats, and it's sweet. And I had only sold about half day before the show, but they said there's a lot of walk-up and ended up selling 75-80%. And it just turns out I get a text the day I got there that a comic I know was in town because he saw the article. He texted me. I was going to go up cold and just blow through an hour 20, hour and a half on my own. But Ahmed was in town. So I said, "What are you up to, man? You want to do 10 before me? Kind of get him into shape?" He said, "Sure." So that was kind of a nice coincidence. And the show was, it was great in a lot of ways. The altitude was kind of fucked up. It kind of screwed with me a little bit. Kind of gets your brain a little screwy. Did I say screwy twice? You want to buy a house? But everything kind of clicked along. You're always sort of out of breath there, even if you're just walking up a 2-3 stairs. And I couldn't sleep that night because of the altitude, because you kind of feel like you're mildly drowning and you kind of wake up every 20 minutes. So, yeah. But dreams, man, the dreams. It was like having a remote that you were flipping through, man. I traveled, man. I learned a lot about things that were percolating in the back of my brain, boy. Things were coming up. It's sort of nice whether you have a fever or whether you're having trouble breathing because you're at an inhumane altitude, that you get the opportunity to get a closer look at just what's teeming about in the old id, what's kicking around in the lizard brain and attaching itself to your regular life. Where are we at there? And if you can remember, make some notes for when you get back. But the show, all good. Got up there, killing, went into some political stuff, got one or two people. One guy's like, "Yeah, what happened to the jokes?" I'm like, "These are the jokes, and you're kind of, everyone was laughing but you're the only one talking." Another guy goes, "Yeah, it was funny before the political stuff." And I was probably more diplomatic than I should have been. I said, "Look, it's going to be done in a minute. You can leave if you want. I'll give you your money back because I got to tell you, in about a half hour into the set, it's going to get pretty gnarly for you. It's going to get a little harder later in the show. I'm going to mix it up, but it's going to get a little rough. I'll give you a heads up to let you know because I don't want to offend your delicate sensibility or your sort of faux victimness." But no one left. Yeah, they just wanted to make it known that they were there and have everybody be not uncomfortable, because right when they opened their mouth, there was sort of a chorus of like, "No, boo." And I'm like, "No, let's not make that happen. I can manage this. I can bridge this gap." And we did. And I did a nice hour and 25 minute set. Left. I went back to the hotel. Couldn't sleep for about 4 hours. Watched American Sniper with commercials. until the very end, which I don't enjoy, but I like when he kills the other sniper. Yeah, finally got to sleep. It was a good show, so all that belly aching on my behalf to you the other day, though it was true and the fear was real, it worked out. You want to buy a house? Huh? How about a house? So now I'm in Boulder. I'm in Boulder, Colorado. It was quite an interesting drive. Beautiful, beautiful drive. But there was a couple of things that made it even more compelling. But let me just lay a couple emails on you. Here we go. This is just from a guy named Ed. Subject line, I never thought of contacting you until ... Please don't get dark. Please don't get dark like you just did on that episode with Tal Wilkenfeld. You scare the shit out of me, dude. Don't. Please don't do anything stupid. Your show keeps me positive, dude. Please don't get down. Please. Don't stop doing what you do. Please. Ed, relax. I wasn't that down. You're kind of an empath because I knew it was under there during that monologue. I knew there was a little tugging sadness, but I wasn't spiraling, pal. And I'll try to keep out of a tailspin for you, Ed. Just relax, Ed, please relax. And thank you for your concern and your email. I appreciate it. So I'm getting ready to perform here in Boulder at the Boulder Theater. It was a beautiful drive. But my buddy Matt Sweeney hit me to this, like there was a link to an NPR thing of a record. There's a link, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right. M-D-O-U is his first name. Mokhtar is the second name. And the album is called Ilana, the Creator. And this is, it's like some sort of Saharan psychedelia. So like I hooked up the link on my phone, and it's just music, man. It's just, it's like a rock album. But I guess the guy plays something called a Tuareg style guitar. It's a Saharan style of music. It's almost trance-like, but it's definitely got a rock sensibility. And it's just, you know, it's so rare that you hear something that kind of bends your sense of what electric guitar is, of what, you know, can or can't be rock music, if it is rock music. But I didn't know anything about it, but the element of the Saharan kind of space. So I'm driving through the Rocky Mountains, man. And I got, you know, snow-covered mountains all around me. I'm going through tunnels and mountains, and I'm just listening to this kind of trancey, like, I don't understand the language. The guy's from Niger, and I don't know anything about him. But just driving through those mountains, it was sort of not counterintuitive, but ironic that I'm listening to Saharan kind of riffage, you know, in, you know, the elevated snow-covered Rockies. But, you know, space is space, man. And when you get into that poetic space where shit just stretches out because of a groove or of a sort of riff that repeats itself, it's almost meditative, just moving in my rented Chevy Equinox through the Rocky Mountains, listening to music from a cat who's from a small village in central Niger, just on fire with his Tuareg guitar sound, bringing the Saharan desert to my car as I move through my own poetic mental state through the Rocky Mountains. Is pretty great. And I think actually, it could work as a commercial for a Chevy Equinox, but that's not really where I was going. It did contain what was happening though, and it did keep us all moving. So that was my experience heading into Boulder. So now here I am in the room talking to you. You want to buy a house? So Rob Lowe, think what you will. Have your ideas, have your sense of him, but I was pleasantly surprised. He's currently hosting Mental Samurai on Fox, Tuesday nights on Fox. He's got a one-man show he tours around that I didn't know about. And of course, I didn't know about his books, but yeah, he tells me. I was actually had a nice time talking to him. This is me talking to Rob.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Well, you want don't wear cans?
Yeah, oh yeah. It makes me sound so much sexier.
Yeah.
I'm already like it's a what? Total difference.
Yeah, right?
Fuck yeah.
Oh, it sounds pretty dead. And you're the first guy I've talked to in this setup.
It's like a 1970s album. It is just dead.
You feel it, right?
Oh, there's no presence at all.
That's crazy. It took a while. It took a lot of these platforms, a lot of these, whatever you call them, speaker walls.
Now this is, I feel like we could be doing a Steely Dan album.
You know, it's funny you bring that up. Are you a Steely Dan fan?
Huge.
Really?
Yeah, huge. I know a lot of people don't get it.
I didn't forever. And now, for some reason, I'm 55 and I put it on and I was like, this kind of...
Yeah, you listen to Hey 19 at your age and you're like, yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
Young girl, really hot, I have nothing in common with.
But all of it is very very clean sounding.
It sounds like they recorded it in space.
Yeah, exactly.
Where no one can hear you scream.
It's kind of relieving, you know?
Yeah. It's funny, I saw this interview with Springsteen. He goes, I hate those 70s songs. It's like the silence in them just makes me want to vomit.
He said that?
Yeah.
Recently?
Yeah. He likes room, as they call it in
sure.
the trade.
Well, that's right. And I think that those guys were anti-room.
Very anti.
Very anti-room.
The Clash, yeah. All those guys. They want to hear like fucking spoons banging the commissary.
Yeah, I like that, though. Yeah. Not for you?
Give me the deadened...
sterile
environment of Fleetwood Mac.
Sure. Well, that, I mean, I can definitely get on board with Fleetwood Mac. So what happened? You came down here from Orange County?
Santa Barbara.
That's where you live?
Yeah. You've been there for 25 years.
Now, yeah, what do you have a large expanse?
I do. It's it's my only extravagance in life, really, is living way beyond my means in my home.
Is that what? So, like, let's start here, though, because, like, I watched the trailer for Mental Samurai, and I know that's what you're here promoting, and I don't usually pay much mind to promoting things. I like to do a longer interview.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, you get the offer for that.
Yeah.
And what's the deliberation there?
What happens is, I get the offer,
yeah.
And I've had over the years, I've had offers to do game shows, or as they like to call them now, what do they call them? Competition series.
Yeah. Well, that's a little more dignified, I guess.
It's a little more dignified. Sure. It's like when they didn't call sitcoms for a really long time.
What did they call them?
Half-hour comedies.
Oh, of course, right, yeah.
And that, I live for euphemisms.
Yeah.
I think they're genius.
Most of them are put in place, so you'll do them.
It doesn't sound so bad. Do you want to randomly end this person's life expectancy?
Yeah.
Murder them.
Yeah. Right. I wonder. Well, that's the thing about that fucking show. I mean, they may not be the game shows that we used to know because of the apparatuses involved.
Yeah. No, it's an
amusement park ride, dude. You've got people winging around in a machine.
The arm cost $4.5 million.
And it's a ride, right? That's part of it. You could get sick and it's not fun if you don't like rides. And
right. Well, I mean, because to your question, the pitch was... We're the people who make American Ninja Warrior. I'm so down. I love that show.
You
it's
do?
Great.
Okay.
Love it. And like, so,
that's the one where they obstacle courses?
Correct.
Right.
So like, well, we want to do an obstacle course for the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Ninja Warriors for the physical.
Sure.
This will be for the mind.
Right.
What does that look like? So I was involved in developing the whole concept with them.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you were there on the ground floor when they were talking about the arm.
Yep, 100%.
The ball that flies around that people are in.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I'm a producer on the show as well. So that's how it works. And
you got a stake.
I got a stake, baby.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd also seen some of my pals like Alec Baldwin doing Match Game or Mike Myers doing his thing or Amy Poehler doing her thing. And they all seem to be having so much fun.
Alec Baldwin did Match Game?
Alec Baldwin's been hosting Match Game for 3 years. Come on, Mark.
Are you serious?
Come on.
I'm sorry, man.
Come on, bro.
You
got to get out of this cat house.
I know. But
deadened room.
Have you talked to him about how he feels about it? I mean, you're saying that they're having a great time, but
Alec says it's the most fun he has.
Really?
And by the way, it was everything I thought. It's so fun. The set, at least my set.
Yeah.
His is Match Game is very retro 70s. He's got the long microphone,
Gene
Rayburn.
There's a campiness to it.
Yeah. Our thing is like this big, amazing world. And to walk on that set and get the butterflies of the LED towers and to see people.
It's like going to Times Square.
It's Times Square and it's yours.
Uh-huh. But like for me, like I hosted a game show once years ago and I was not into it at all. I had integrity. I was mad, but I was... But I was broke. You're just laughing at the idea of integrity.
Yes, I'm laughing at the idea. You had integrity. How dare you? Wait. You're in show business and you had integrity.
I still do. Look where I'm doing my job. Right. I'm at home. You know this.
You're not working for the man.
I'm not really.
No, you're not. No, it's true.
But you know, there was a lot of lean years though. There's a price to pay when you don't work for the man.
I know.
I was fortunate in that the man didn't want to hire me anyway, so I did all right.
It's perfect.
But I could not like wrap my brain around the fucking rules of the game. So I knew I was playing a game and that I had teams, but there was no stakes in this game. It was an improv game.
Oh.
So it wasn't a money game.
Right.
So it was just like, and so the rules had a little play to them. But your game, you know, there's that, you know, answer the question, don't answer the question, you lost the money.
Yeah.
And
under a time constraint.
And
under a machine that's trying to kill you.
So you're excited about it.
Really, listen, at this point in my life, there are fewer and fewer things that I haven't done.
Uh-huh.
So when I get to do something that's really new, where I literally don't know anything, I mean, and I say this with all humility.
Yeah.
A lot of times on a set, I'm the smartest guy in the room. Just because I've been doing it forever.
Right, in terms of acting.
And all of it.
Yeah.
And to go to a place where I literally know nothing.
Right.
Is fun? Is really fun.
I guess that's true. Like, because I was looking at the career arc here, and I mean, you really have not stopped working.
No,
since the 80s.
Oh, since 1979. I was 15 years old. I did my first sitcom or half hour comedy.
Really?
Yeah, A New Kind of Family. Yeah. ABC. I'm 15 years old. I got the David Cassidy hair going.
Yeah.
And that was really the beginning.
Oh, so that, yeah, okay, there it is, 79.
Frightening.
You were 15.
Yeah.
We're like the same age-ish, you 55?
55 this last weekend.
Yeah, I turned 55 in September. So, but you didn't grow up here, right?
No, I grew up in Ohio.
Really, in which part of Ohio?
Dayton.
That's the whole time that you grew up in Dayton?
Yep.
Till 15?
Till 13.
Yeah, and then what happened?
My parents divorced.
When you were 13?
My mom divorced twice. Once when I was 5 from my father, and then from my stepfather when I was 13. And then she came out to moved us all out to L.A.
And I
was like, any 13-year-old didn't want to go.
It was just you and your brother, Chad.
Yep.
The only and now like your real dad.
Yep.
Is he totally out of the picture?
He's still in our lives, but he's still in Dayton, still practicing law, and at 80 years old.
So both exes. Are in Dayton. Both of your moms, your stepdad and your dad are in Dayton.
Yeah.
And you like both of them.
Yeah. Yep.
All good.
All good. I've been very blessed in that way.
Are they both lawyers?
No. My dad is a lawyer. My stepdad is long since retired.
Uh-huh. What was that? What did he do?
He literally invested in the earliest, what was it called? You know when you used to take your pictures to like a... A photo map.
Yeah.
He was one of the early investors in Photomat and just took that money and like...
And that was it.
That's it.
So he made his killing, then he just...
Yeah.
And he knows how to live life?
Yeah, he's unbelievably cheap.
Oh.
He's utilitarian and Spartan.
Yeah.
So he's made it go a long way.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. So your mom's like, she had enough of that.
Yeah.
And she's like, I'm fucking going to L.A.
Coming to L.A., I did not want to, even though I wanted to be an actor.
What was her plan?
Her plan was she wanted to go somewhere. I mean, she was done with the Midwest.
Right.
Right.
She's still around?
No. Oh. She died young.
Sorry.
64, and thank you. So the L.A. for me was like a mixed bag.
Yeah.
Because I missed my friends. 13's a hard year to leave anywhere when, you know, it's beginning of adolescence.
What part of the town were you in?
We moved to Point Doom. In Malibu, which my mom chose because it had the cleanest air quality in all of Southern California.
That's way out there, man.
Way out. And in those days, living in Malibu in the mid-70s was like being in like the Ice Storm meets Lord of the Flies meets Boogie Nights, but directed by people on blow.
So you're just, you know, out there. It's all like, it's just you and Bob Dylan and the people that are.
Bob Dylan was secretly buying all of the tract homes.
Yeah.
When I moved out there.
Yeah.
And then knocked them all down and built his mansion with like
an
onion on the dome.
With the dome. Say,
yeah, exactly.
So did you see Bob Dylan around?
Bob Dylan would come to my brother's soccer games.
Because he had a kid in the game?
Yep.
Jacob or the
it
other
was
one?
Jacob.
Yeah. So that was just, so you just see Bob Dylan
You'd
sitting
see Bob
there.
Dylan there, you know, smoking a joint. You'd yeah. see David Carradine from Kung Fu on acid walking the Pacific Coast Highway.
Hanging around?
You'd see Mick Fleetwood at the Trancas Bar.
That was the community?
That and then like firefighters and doc and like dentists and accountants and like really sort of upper middle class working people.
So you're stranded there with your brother and Bob Dylan and Mick Fleetwood. Mm-hmm. And are you older or younger?
I'm the oldest.
Right. So, and you're depressed.
And slowly getting over it, because let's face it, it's Southern nice. California and it's gorgeous yeah. and the ocean's there. And I think I was probably happy to be there within a year.
Yeah. And when you wanted to be an actor from early on?
Yeah, I think I did my first community theater. I was 8.
Oh, yeah? Do yeah. you remember it?
Yeah, it was Oliver.
Oh, really?
With all the little kids in it.
Right? Were you Oliver?
Hell no, I couldn't get the lead yet.
You were just
my first thing.
One of the kids with a bowl?
Please, sir, I want some more, whatever it was.
Yeah, yeah.
My accent is still bad.
Yeah, you can't do that one, I guess.
No, no.
You can do a lot of other things.
Yeah, but that's not in the
English
card.
Accents. No accents for you.
No, I've thrown down with some accents in the past, but English accents are scary.
There's a lot of different kinds.
That's the problem.
Like, what kind of accents have you done?
Well, I did Kennedy.
Oh, that's right.
And that was one of the big ones, because everybody, that's such an iconic accent.
Did you get flack?
No, I got a Screen Actors Guild Award for that baby.
Oh,
so that one went really well, but
because that's a tough one. That's an easy one.
Really want you? You'll end up sounding like you're on The Simpsons,
right? It's an easy one to mangle. How are you?
Yeah, well,
yeah.
Go get the car. You know.
So did you have to study with a coach, or did you just like lock in?
What's great about the internet
yeah.
is there's so much footage available of a public figure. I just listened to hours and hours and hours and hours of him speaking.
Did you learn things?
I learned so much.
How are you still a Republican after that?
he would have been a Republican today.
I don't know.
John Kennedy today, 100% his politics. He would have been a Democrat.
You think he would have been a Republican?
What is the word I'm looking for? Mentally, spiritually, morally, he would have stayed a Democrat, but his policies today, absolutely.
His fiscal policies and his military
policies. Yeah, yeah. And even, listen, he was not Johnny on the spot with civil rights.
Uh-huh.
That took him.
No one was.
But to my thing of like yeah. Democrat, Republican, it took yeah. him a while to get there.
Sure.
But I learned a lot about Kennedy. Little things that, here's my pet peeve when critics talk about accents.
Yeah.
Or people like, I thought it was inconsistent.
Oh, right.
Meanwhile, John Kennedy said the word decade 2 different ways uh-huh. in his own life.
Yeah.
So John Kennedy was inconsistent with his
right.
own. We will go to the moon within the decade.
Yeah. Maybe.
And then he would say decade.
Yeah.
So it was decade.
Well, maybe it was just a bad day, had a little brain fart.
I know. Meanwhile, you got to pick one way to say it when you're playing him.
Maybe you didn't have 2 opportunities to say decade.
No.
You could have said both ways.
Right.
But how did you get in? What was the first sort of, how did you enter acting? Did your mom take you to auditions? Was it that kind of thing?
I saw a play. I don't remember which one it was. And there were kids in it. And I told my mom I wanted to do that.
Oh, that was back in Ohio.
And she was like, okay. And I'm sure she thought it was no different than a kid saying, you know, I'd like to go to baseball camp this summer.
Right.
But the difference was I was deadly serious about it and meant it from day one. I don't know what to attribute it to.
Huh.
And my parents were, I think, the sort of perfect mix of really supportive,
yeah.
but also not in any way stage parents.
Right. They were just sort of drop them off, fuck it.
Yeah, totally. Take the bus. Well, from Malibu, you know how far. I would take the bus.
Come
this.
On, man. That's so
at
far.
At 13,
yeah.
I would take the bus from Malibu.
Yeah.
Into Hollywood and Vine.
They just let us do that shit when we were kids.
To audition, 100%. They were like, just take the bus.
Yeah.
It's nuts to think
of
it today.
3 hours.
And then
and
you're
walking into, like, you know, Sodom.
Yeah, you're walking into some guy is like, hi. No. Yeah, and, you know, that you do the scene, turn
around. Did you have to deal with that?
Yes and no. I mean, it was like, you know, Hollywood is full of creepy dudes.
Yeah,
and creepy girls. Yeah. Creepy people.
I think you had a window there where you were considered one of them.
Yeah, listen. Listen, if you don't do your time in the barrel, you know, you're not, you don't have a long career.
Oh, the time in the barrel joke. Oh, boy. Yeah, everyone's afraid of their time in the barrel.
It's coming for everyone.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Come on.
Yes.
So, all right, so you're 13 and you're taking the bus to Hollywood from Malibu, but no one's teaching you acting. No one's doing nothing. You're just going out on what, casting calls? You have no agent? You just...
I got an agent. A really tiny, you know, commercial agent. Their big other client was Vince Ferragamo, you know, good-looking quarterback guy. And
it was just you and him?
And a young 13-year-old girl who originated the role of Annie named Sarah Jessica Parker.
Wow.
We were the big clients.
And you're about the same age?
Exactly.
Oh, wow. So she came out. So she was the big star he had.
Big.
How'd you get the agent?
Through my dad had represented someone in a divorce.
Yeah.
Who had
out
come
here
in Dayton.
Yeah.
Who had come to Hollywood and become an agent. And he cold called her and she said, "Yeah, I'll meet Rob." And, you know, one thing led to another and it was sort of a fluke.
But you didn't get her, you got someone she knew.
I got that agent.
Oh, she was working for an agent.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's wild.
Yeah.
And he just started sending you out. Didn't get you set up with classes or anything.
No. And the other thing is I wouldn't, because I was I was 13. I wouldn't have really, living in Malibu, I wouldn't have really had the time to come all the way in for, it was school, you know, school and auditions. And I'm pretty much 100% self-taught. I mean, I studied in the sort of middle of my career. My wife said to me, "You know, you might want to think about acting lessons." I was like, "Oh, great, thank you. That's really
was this a few years ago?
Wonderful."
In 2002,
it was like in the 90s, uh-huh. Like the middle of my career. And I thought, you know what, fuck it. I've never taken a proper acting class.
Yeah,
and I'll do it. And it was great. I learned a lot. I was playing a deaf mute in Stephen King's The Stand.
Yeah,
It's a sort of really renowned book and a renowned part. And I'll never forget going.
Is that the plague book?
Yes.
Yeah.
Which incidentally they're remaking.
Yeah.
And I'm deaf in one ear anyway.
Yeah.
So my idea
was, how'd that happen?
They think I had the mumps when I was a kid and totally undiagnosed, so as long as I can remember.
Okay.
So my idea was to do something with the ear that I could hear with.
Yeah.
To really, you know, go methody, whatever. And then I met this acting coach and he was like, "Yeah, sure, you could do that. But if you want to work with me, what you need to realize is you do hear and you can talk. Yeah. So you need to play the character as a person who can hear and can talk and fools everybody into thinking that they can't." I was like, "Well, wait, I'm sorry, what?"
Yeah.
He's like, "The less lying you're doing as an actor, the better you'll be."
Isn't it all lying?
It's all lying. Like he says, "I represent the guy who plays the dead body in," what was the first Quentin Tarantino movie? Reservoir Dogs.
Oh, yeah.
So in Reservoir Dogs, they kill a guy and his body lies in the background.
Right.
That was his big client.
Yeah.
He goes, "And I told him, you will be alive. You're not dead. You can't play dead. That's impossible.
Right.
So what you have to play is a man pretending to play dead in this movie."
Uh-huh.
I was like, okay.
That doesn't even make sense. It defeats the guy's original argument.
But
the less pretending you're doing.
But he's alive.
Right.
He can't pretend he's dead.
Okay. So that was the exception?
And he said he got good, he actually got reviewed as a dead body.
Come on.
It's fucking amazing.
So he wouldn't let you stick something in your ear?
No, wouldn't have it.
And you didn't do it. You didn't end up doing that. You didn't end up sticking something in your ear.
I did not. I took his advice for that role.
And did it pay off?
I got really good reviews.
So when you start getting the movies that you're known for, like, I can't even, was The Outsiders was the big one, right?
Yeah, probably. I mean, it was Coppola, who at that time was probably the most famous and infamous director around.
Why was he infamous, you think?
He was infamous because he was coming off of a moment where he was the first director to buy his own studio.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And
so he's doing that weird Technicolor thing.
And he's also doing the movie One from the Heart, which was on the cover of Time. And
Rumblefish, sort of, right?
That was after
right,
Outsiders.
Right.
But so it was he, you know, he went Godfather 1, Godfather 2, you know, Conversation, all of these great movies, and then One from the Heart, which was sort of a one of the big boondoggles.
Yeah.
And so he was very controversial.
It was his big idea and it failed.
Yeah.
To do it all on the soundstage. And he
was
And he was the first guy to, you know, to be able to edit on the spot because he had TV monitors hooked up.
100%.
Right. So he could see the shots over again immediately.
100%. First video monitor hookup I ever saw was the auditions for The Outsiders.
And but that was really kind of defined that, you know, the whole generation of you guys.
Totally.
You were all in it, kind of.
Totally, and spoiled us for, I thought all movies were going to be made the way Francis made The Outsiders.
Why was it great?
Because he's Francis Ford Coppola, and he does it his way, and he had a vision. He's a true auteur.
Yeah.
I mean, he won an Oscar for writing Patton.
Yeah.
So he's a real auteur, and there really aren't that many auteurs in our business anymore.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, there's Chris Nolan.
There's a couple. There's a lot of indie auteurs, but big movies, they seem to be less about the auteurs.
Right.
But there were definitely a few around.
They're still around.
Yeah.
But in those days, everybody wanted to be an auteur.
Right. Well, he was one of the guys, right? Yeah. He was one of the new generation of hotshots. But so working with, I just want to look at that, hold on, that cast real quick.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's C. Thomas Howell, Matt Dillon, Ralph Macchio, Patrick Swayze, you, Diane Lane, Estevez, Cruz, and Leif Garrett.
Teen Idol. I found out later, they literally cast a lot of it by who was on the cover of Tiger Beat magazine.
Is that true?
That is, I just found this out a few years ago.
Had you been yet?
In an autobiography. I had been from A New Kind of Family.
How many episodes did you do of that? Was that a long-running show, A New Kind of Family?
We did 13. No, it was opposite 60 Minutes. Literally, yeah. it was a death slot.
Sunday night,
and we were, I remember there were 62 shows on the schedule because we were always 62nd. Right. We're literally the lowest rated show on network television.
But you learned some tricks.
Oh, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I learned the whole thing. And then, you know, the Outsiders came along and the rest was history.
And you were friends with those guys.
Yeah, really close with all of them. Like when I see, you know, if I see Tom Cruise, we're like, it's like running into a fraternity brother.
Yeah.
You know, like it doesn't matter how much time's gone by. You immediately know them on a level that very few people do.
So like all you guys, well, I mean, specifically, well, C. Thomas Howell, Dylan, Ralph, well, Swayze was a little older, right?
Yeah, he was substantially older.
Yeah, and Tom, you're all sort of on the same trajectory. That was the momentum. And then you started doing the big, you know, what became defined as those Brat Pack movies.
Yep.
Now, were you just out of control? I mean, Class. I remember Class. That's the other guy. What's that? What was that guy's name?
Andrew McCarthy.
Yeah, what happened to that guy?
He is around. I think he's does a lot of writing, of travel writing or something. Somebody was telling me.
Isn't it weird that, you know, how people make do when it doesn't quite work out?
Everybody's got to hustle.
It's true, right?
Everybody, yeah.
But you had a pretty amazing run there of movies. Class was good. That was, what, Jacqueline Bisset, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hotel New Hampshire. Who was in that one?
Jodie Foster.
Wow.
Nastassja Kinski at her most beautiful.
Yeah.
Directed by Tony Richardson.
Right.
You know, the great director.
And Beau Bridges. Wilford Brimley.
Wilford Brimley was the best. I remember meeting him, and he's like, we're driving to the set.
Yeah.
And it was the first time I'd ever met a real true character actor.
Right.
Like a ringer.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget, he's like, son, what do they call you in this movie? I said, what do you mean? What do they call my character?
Yeah.
He goes, yeah. Well, they call me Jono. He goes, well, then that's what I'll call you, Jono. And I realized he'd only read his part.
Right.
And he dies like 30 pages into the movie.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, ew. And now fast forward X amount of years later, I get an offer, I only read my part, fuck it.
You do? I think we were up for the same part.
You're kidding.
No. It's a rumor. I guess we could put it to rest right now.
Tell me this rumor.
I play the manager in GLOW, the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling.
Oh.
And I was told that they didn't know who they were going to go with, but they were thinking you. Did it make it to you?
It did not.
Ah. Yeah, damn. It would have been, a spicier conversation.
Oh, I would have loved it. I would have loved it.
Do you know the show?
I do know. Of course I know the show.
Yeah, that's me.
Okay, I'm going to have to watch it. I mean, I'm yeah, aware of it, and I've seen the billboards, and I know people love it.
Yeah, yeah. I'm the cranky, slightly...
Sounds genius. Sort of jaded.
Downtrodden.
Oh, genius.
Little coked up, failed director.
Oh, goddamn, this sounds like right up my alley.
I know, you blew it.
Fuck.
Yeah. You could have really turned things around.
Jesus.
You wouldn't be hosting the ARM show. You would... you're probably making a lot more money with the ARM, with the giant ball. What do you call it, the machine?
Ava.
Ava?
Ava. Ava, bring the contestant up here.
Well, what do you do?
Oh, yeah, I talked to Ava. Talks.
She talks.
Oh, yeah. She asks the questions.
So, but what kind of ride is it? What kind of device is it?
It was designed for NASA to test the astronauts.
Oh, no shit. So it's an existing machine.
It was an existing machine that we found because the big struggle was if we can't find something to legitimately put our players under duress, we don't have a show. And we found this device.
So that thing can get going pretty good.
I think it goes to, it's like Spinal Tap. It goes to 11 and we can't do it any farther than a 2 or it'll kill someone.
So you do people sign releases? And
oh, yeah. Hell yeah.
Have there been any accidents with Ava?
No, because we have like so many fail safes to prevent the thing from going wild.
All right, so you do these great movies that everyone loves, St. Elmo's Fire. You didn't get The Breakfast Club, though. That wasn't you.
It's funny. I auditioned for The Breakfast Club and I did not get it. Clearly, John Hughes had no use for me.
He didn't like you.
I could have literally been in. I mean, how many John Hughes movies could I have been in? Honestly,
Most of them, every
one of them, right?
Sure, as a slightly bad guy.
Anything?
Yeah,
I would have taken. How about never? How about my phone never rang from John Hughes ever?
Is that a resentment that you have?
I'm holding a deep seated. even when he died, I was just resentful.
Uh huh. But About Last Night, that was from the Mammoth play, right?
Yeah, that's probably my favorite of that era.
That was a big movie.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, these were all sort of like, because we were the same age, you always seemed to have been there in my childhood.
Mm.
But then like, okay, so here, I guess the big question is, so all these guys that you start out with, like, well, Tom Cruise specifically, and other people kind of leveled off, but he became a huge star. Now, did you feel you were on the trajectory of that?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I think I think we probably all, if you would have asked us then, felt like we were all on the trajectory.
Even Judd Nelson?
But taking different paths. Oh, I remember vividly being on the set of St. Elmo's Fire and the studio president showing up and stiffing all of us and going to Judd and taking him into the corner and offering him like this big movie. And we were all like... Wow.
Okay. And that was The Breakfast Club?
It was
no.
Blue City.
Oh, yeah. That one.
Turned out it wasn't a big movie, but I remember like he was the guy that like the studio was like, yeah, he's the man. He's who we're betting on.
He's got the intensity. The sad thing about me, you know, bringing up these people in sort of a condescending or dismissive way is that they're all people and they might listen to this and I'll probably have to talk to Judd.
Listen, I think you've been very even-handed.
Have I?
Yes.
Because I've been in this a long time, but it's been a real slow build for me and it was just the right speed and I'm fine. But I always wonder, like, you know, how people, you know, shoulder the burden of just sort of disappearing or public failure. But they never seem to go away.
Well, because nobody really ever does. They're always working. We're just not aware of it. You
that's
know
right,
I mean?
Right,
I mean,
right.
That's what it is. And what you have to learn is if you're going to have a long career, there are going to be periods for everyone. I don't care who it is. You name a person and I will tell you their fallow period.
Yeah.
And I will tell you...
You have a big board at home?
Yeah, I do.
Just to compare yourself to?
No,
like, I went down, but that guy went way down.
No, you must not ever compare yourself to others. You know this. But
you had to learn that, didn't you?
You have to learn, keep your head down, do your own work, and, you know, will change. I'm not sure I ever really had an epiphany about it. I think it's just something that's gradually... become apparent.
But let's, like, deal with this. So you're fucking, you know, you're doing good. Things are like, you know, everything's going your way. And then like this videotape shows up and there you are naked and, you know, fucking.
Listen, let me see if I can get this straight. I'm a 20-year-old.
I'm not judging you.
There was a little judgment, I thought.
No. I mean, like, who hasn't made a tape?
Exactly. By the way, here's my the real fuck up was that I didn't wait 20 years later to do it, where it would have helped my career.
Yeah. You were ahead of the curve, man, on public controversy over a sex tape.
1,000,000,000% ahead of the curve.
But like, I have to assume that, like, I can't even imagine the panic and horror and, you know, stress that you must have went through. Did you?
I mean, by the way, it's 30 years ago.
I know.
So it's hard for me to remember a lot of it. But my notion of it was, it was all like happening so fast.
Yeah.
And that it was just sort of putting one foot in front of the other.
Right. But you felt the backlash.
Dude.
Yeah.
I turned on the NBC Nightly News.
Uh-huh. And you saw
today in America, actor Rob Lowe is about. And then, like, they do, that was like, that's Tom Brokaw leading the news. And literally, and another news in Tiananmen Square, violence is erupting. And it was like the guy standing in front of the tank.
Yeah.
That was the second story.
Yeah. And the first one was a pixelated you.
Yeah, it was me. Yeah, 100%.
Oh my god! But like,
here's the thing. It's like, between that and some of the other things that have happened in my life, like, I would have no memoir to write.
Yeah,
and I'd have no one man show that I'd take out and have a blast with.
Have you done either?
Without those things, I would have none of those.
But are these? Did I miss the memoir?
Two bestsellers, baby.
Yeah?
Yep.
So you laid it out
there. New York Times bestsellers.
And the one-man show?
And the one-man show. Sold out all over the world. I'm in the middle of doing it right now.
Are you really?
Yeah, I did. I just played Royal Festival Hall in London.
I've done that room.
Yeah, right? It's a big...
It's 2400.
Yes, yeah. And it's beautiful, right?
It's great. They have the giant organ there.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm going back there in a couple of weeks.
Oh, you're kidding.
Nope.
Yeah, I loved it there.
Yeah,
I loved that place.
So the one-man show is new.
I've been doing it for about a year. Yeah, so it's new. I'm playing Vegas for the first time, which is exciting because it's like, I feel like the notion that I would have a billboard over the Vegas Strip playing, you know,
Rob
is something I never would have thought of.
And what's it called?
Stories I Only Tell My Friends, live, because that was the first book.
Okay, really? So you're just dishing with some humor, raconteuring.
It's an evening of stories, 100%.
Yeah.
But if you read the, you got to read the books because it's,
I feel like I didn't do my homework.
No. You would love them. But just because it's like a style of celebrity memoir that doesn't exist anymore. Like I was,
what, drinking stories and whatnot.
I mean, it's like David Niven wrote the high watermark.
Right.
You know?
It's a very dirty one, right?
The moon's a balloon.
Right. Yeah.
It's very insightful. It's hilarious. And like it gives you all of the insight behind the curtain you want, and yet no one gets hurt. It's not exploitive,
right?
And it's also sneakily moving.
Sure.
So that was what I wanted, and the books,
because you got an arc. You know, you did rise from the ashes to a certain degree.
Yeah, to a certain degree.
Kept going.
I'm still clawing my way up, baby. It's a long road.
But what's like? So did you? You wrote it all yourself?
Oh yeah.
And does it build to, like, is there a third act? Is there a denouement? Is there a story that, you know, kind of like you focus on? Is it the tapes, or what's the story in the middle that then you come out of and end up?
It's a really interesting structure because I just know what I like in a memoir is like, I don't want it to be linear because a lot of times I don't care what people were like before they were famous.
Yeah.
Honestly, I just don't care.
Yeah.
I just want to know, let me know about the famous part.
Yeah.
And in other books, like Quincy Jones's book, for example, his non-famous life is actually almost more interesting.
Right.
So I mixed it up. So it sort of goes through different timelines.
So no, you know, Dayton, Ohio Community Theater.
Oh,
stories.
That's in there, 100%.
Yeah.
In Malibu, it's Malibu, Dayton Community Theater, the you know, all it, there's nothing that's not in it, because job one, if you're going to do a one-man show or if you're going to do a memoir, is you better be honest. You better be authentic.
Yeah.
And not full of shit.
Yeah. And you do that.
Yeah.
And so now when you decided to do this, you know, along with the Mental Samurai and this other stuff, I mean, is this something that you've always wanted to do, theater, or is it like, you know, I got to get some other cash flow coming in?
No, it's really as simple as, you know, I'm in my fifth decade.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's harder and harder and harder to get my adrenaline up doing traditional acting stuff because I've been doing it for so long. So when I to go out by myself on stage alone and entertain people with something I've written for 90 minutes on the Vegas Strip or the Royal Festival Hall, that gets my adrenaline going. To, you know, try to produce and host and deal with do a whole genre that I've never been in, don't have any knowledge about in the game show world, that gets my adrenaline going.
So you're re-engaged.
Yeah, because listen, I'm 55 years old. I gotta keep being re-engaged and curious.
Do you get bored on set?
A lot. Oh, it's brutal. There's nothing more brutal than the boredom on a set.
That's what I find. You know, all my life I've wanted these opportunities to act, and then I get them, and I'm like, whew, well, that was a nice 3 minutes of work. Now how long?
I know.
Two hours.
Now you know why everybody's, you know, doing drugs.
Yeah.
And everything else.
It's hard to figure out what to do with your time. So what, were you writing?
Exactly.
Well, you were never a drug guy, huh?
Oh, in the day I was. I mean, I've been sober now for 20—I don't want to get ahead of myself, but it'll be 29 years in May.
Oh, yeah? Like active sober?
Yeah, no, sober, 100%.
Yeah, I'm coming up on 20. Do you do the thing?
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I do the thing. Yeah. Sure. I do the thing, 100%.
So when did you... So that's...
You got 20. Yeah, baby.
Yeah, it's coming... August is 20. So you got it. You did it 10 years before me, so you were in your 20s?
Yeah,
and
so
you were like, I'm
26,
done?
Yeah.
What was that day like?
I was done, dude. I mean, you know what it's like.
But I don't know what it was like at your level. I mean, you're running around with Judd Nelson and some guy named Chewy. Probably like I don't know anything about Judd Nelson, but I have to assume that the access you had to the environments that you could get into and live with, it must have been a lot more exciting than mine.
I'm out on the road,
yeah. You know, in fucking, you know. Minneapolis with some guy I don't know with an eye patch.
Yes.
Who brought the shit and the other comic.
Yeah. No, yeah. I'm in the grotto at the Playboy Mansion.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
And you're in 22.
Yeah, I'm 22. Uh-huh. And I'm single.
Uh-huh.
So it was
great. But you're on coke, so not great.
Oh, no, great.
Okay. Yeah.
Dude, great. Who are we kidding? Listen, drugs and alcohol are great.
Yeah.
Until they're not.
Yeah.
And it was not good. And it took me a while to figure that out. But when I did, I was truly, well and truly done.
Did you see people go down? Were you afraid for your life?
No, not yet. Because I've since seen that a ton. I've lost more friends and seen more people go down since I've gotten sober.
From the shit?
Than I did then.
Oh, yeah.
Part of it was I'd met my wife and I knew that she was the one for me and that if I couldn't make it work with her, I was probably doomed.
Oh, yeah.
To end up like my biggest nightmare would be Warren Beatty in Shampoo, where you're like alone on Christmas Eve, standing on Mulholland Drive, watching the sun go down and all of your bimbos don't want to see you. That's sort of where the worst iteration of myself, I thought,
yeah.
And I thought the only way to make this work with this great woman was to get sober.
Did she demand it?
No, she was great. But she was also like, I love you. I'll be your friend. Mm. I'll be your friend forever.
Right.
But I can't be with you.
If you're going to be
like this. And then I had, also my grandfather had just died. So there was like a lot of things that just happened at that moment. They weren't massively earth shaking.
Yeah.
But it was enough to get me to be like, I'm done.
That's quite a crossroads where you like you're the projection of what your life would be, loneliness, you know, because you had no intimate relationships, really
none,
and you just realize that if I don't lock into this with this woman and get off of this shit, I'm going to regret it for the rest of my life.
When I really felt like it was like the game Frogger, and you're on that log, and you're like, do I jump now? And the lily pad comes, you go, this is the last lily pad. This is it. You got to get on this pad, or you're done.
Did you ever have any nights where you almost, like, died?
No, I was very professional at it. I was never stoned on the set, ever.
Yeah. Was it blow?
It was the right mixture.
Of blow and booze?
Of blow and booze. Mm. Like, getting that mixture right was heavenly.
Yeah, yeah. And it lasts about an hour.
And then, yeah.
And then you're just fucked up on coke.
Yeah, exactly.
you're awake with nothing to do.
That's exactly what it was.
Yeah.
And then, you know, but I almost immediately found that my biggest fear getting sober was I wouldn't have any more fun.
Yeah.
That was honestly my biggest fear, that I'd become one of those boring people, one of those, you know, Bible thumpers about
recovery.
Sobriety.
Yeah.
And, dude, I currently have a massive wine cellar that's amazing.
Yeah.
And it's for my guests, and I want people to have fun, and I love being around people who can still do what I used to do, and it's still working for them. I have no judgments at all. And
I just collect wine as a hobby?
No, if you're going to be a good guest.
Yeah, a good host.
Yeah, a good host. A host is what I meant. But, like, I found out very quickly that there's way more fun in sobriety than there was getting high.
Right. Well, it's weird because once, like, not only do you still have a good time, but you're so fucking nuts for the first couple of years that you're not really thinking about fun anyways. You're just sort of like, this is fucked. What the, this is what it is? You know, and there's
I had the opposite. I was like euphoric.
Really?
For the first 2 or 3 years.
I was just angry. I'd go to meetings and I'd be like, fuck you people. I don't want to be here. This is bullshit.
Oh, really?
Yeah, man. Because I just ran out of choices. Like, it was undeniable that I was going to, you know, not live or be a productive person if I didn't do it. But I did it because of a woman as well.
Mm.
But I got in there. But I was, you know, I knew I had to be there. But, you know, I wanted to fight it.
That's interesting. I was done fighting. I was, what did they say? I was sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Sure, sure. So you were just sort of like relieved once you got...
If they'd have told me to stand in the corner on my head for 5 hours a day to stay sober, I would have done it.
Yeah? Do you sponsor people?
I don't as much as I should.
I don't either because it's weird sometimes for me.
Yeah,
I know we shouldn't be talking about it, but I do on the show, so it's okay.
You know, and I do, but I'm a big believer in you know, the program.
Sure.
And more than anything, it's given me the tools to lead my life in so many other areas. That's the real thing. I mean,
well, that's the thing they say. If you put your sobriety first, everything will fall into line.
And I haven't thought, the notion of drinking or using, I would be as likely to do that as I would to go to Mars. It's that my issue is like living life on life's terms and using all of those tools that I've learned.
Right.
And they've just changed, they've changed my life.
I never think about it. And when I do think about it, it's so scary and exhausting.
I know. You know,
like, sitting in front of a bunch of lines. I mean, can you fucking imagine our age?
So I have you have reoccurring dreams about it? Because here's my...
Occasionally.
I have three reoccurring dreams. One is it's junior high and I'm at school and I forgot to wear clothes.
Yeah.
And I'm like trying to hide. There's that dream.
Yeah.
I have, it's opening night. I'm standing backstage. The lights go up and I have forgotten to learn the lines. Right. Yeah. And then the other one is I come to a realization that I've been drinking.
Oh, and you haven't told
all
anybody.
Along.
Oh, yeah.
But didn't know I was drinking.
Right.
And now I have the choice of, do I tell people?
Right.
Do I? Yeah. And that's the reoccurring dream I have, and I have it a lot.
I've had similar ones like that where like I'm using, and I haven't told anybody, and I'm just living in this lie.
Right?
Yeah, it's weird.
And then it's all about like. And by the way, I love when I have the dream because it's a little bit of experiencing what it would be like.
Yeah. It's so funny, the stage fright line, that panic in that moment is crazy.
Oh. I on opening night of A Few Good Men at the Royal Haymarket in London.
Yeah.
Aaron Sorkin and I are there. It's and the critics all come on opening night in the UK. It's not like here where you never know
Is this the first time it's there?
This is the first time it's there. First time we've ever done the show.
Oh yeah.
And I'm playing Lieutenant Caffey and I have somebody on the witness stand. And it's a courtroom drama. Like it's like there's plot. And I realize that I've jumped 2.5 pages ahead.
Whoa. Yeah.
And I'm like, this is a nightmare.
You had to self-correct.
And I had to figure out a way to weave it back. But that's my biggest holy shit moment involving dialogue and lines with huge stakes.
And did you pull it off?
I pulled it off and no one was the wiser. The only person who would have known would have been Aaron himself. And he'd gone out to smoke a cigarette and missed it. Thank God.
He must have been pretty excitable then too.
Yeah, he's one of the great. I mean,
I interviewed him. He's real sober too.
Yeah,
he's real locked in.
Yeah, he's the best.
Well, after the controversy, though, I mean, it doesn't seem like you stopped working, and it feels to me that because of that, it gave you a sort of a weird opportunity to explore roles that you probably wouldn't have.
100%.
You could be whatever the fuck you wanted.
Well, it removed a ton of pressure in that way. It also coincided with a really awkward time for traditional leading men.
Yeah.
Your mid to late 20s is usually, it's changed now because the business has changed a lot. But in those days, it was not a great time. You were too young really to play parts with substance.
Right.
And you were too old to play the young ingenues that you've been playing.
Yeah.
So it sort of also coincided with a time that was going to be rough anyway. And then as I got a little bit older, more parts with a little more depth and a little more interesting started to come my way. And I think hosting Saturday Night Live, the first time I did it for sure, opened the door to the whole Mike Myers, Lorne Michaels, Wayne's World, Austin Powers, Tommy Boy sort of comedies that I did.
So yeah, you were able to do you're good at playing some weird, horrible version of yourself for comedic effect.
100%. 100%.
But I remember that movie, The Bad Influence.
Oh, thank you. That was a good one. I like that one.
That's a menacing movie, man.
That's a really, talk about a movie that's before its time.
And you were just sober then? Or a few
no,
years?
No, it was right at the end.
Because that's that character's fucked up.
Oh, it is the most demented movie, demented character. And I mean, and it was right when the video came out.
Yeah. Right.
It was right at the height of my craziness.
So culturally, you were a fucking sordid figure.
Yeah,
so
I was living. Yeah. I was living the character.
Yeah, and it's what was the angle? The one scene I remember that I can't get out of my mind because is when James Spader, the character who plays his brother, comes to the door and he's just like, "Yeah, could you just tell him I have the fear?" And you're like, "Go fuck you!"
Have the fear.
Yeah, because he's high and he's fucked up, and he just slammed the door in his face. But remind me what the angle was.
It was basically I was in iteration of the devil.
Right. Right. But what was your what were you doing to Spader? How did you met him? You guys were friends, or the character in the movie?
I came up to him in a bar.
Right.
And he was telling me his sob story, and I just charmed myself into his life. And the one thing that I get him to do, because he's in a relationship to be engaged
to
this.
To fuck some,
and it's clear he doesn't love her, but he should marry her, and she's rich, and he should do it, but it's really clear he doesn't want to do it. So I get him to fuck some girl, and I film it.
Right.
And then I go to the engagement party, and I put it on for the family to see. And then he goes, and he's like, "What are you doing?" And I go, "I'm saving your life." It's such a great, it's a David Koepp script. So David Koepp then went on to write everything from Jurassic Park to Carlito's Way. He's one of the most renowned screenwriters in our business, but this was his very, I think it was his first or second script.
It's a crazy movie.
Yeah, it's really, really fun.
But I imagine, oddly, that because of the controversy surrounded you, and then you play this iteration of the devil, and there's a sex tape in the movie, that must have re-ingratiated you to Hollywood in some new way. They were sort of like, "I don't know, this guy, maybe we can work with this."
Well, you know.
The fallen Rob Lowe.
Listen, everybody loves a redemption story.
Yeah.
And I also think that, no matter who you are, if you've legitimately got it, you're always a threat.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
You can just do it.
You're always a threat,
you keep your looks. You're not all beat up.
No, and look, and everybody, like I said, everybody has their time in the barrel. There's being in the barrel for something embarrassing, and then there's being in the barrel for doing something wrong, and that's a totally totally different thing. It's I just having put my kids through college. Both of them are done.
Wow.
One's in law school now, so he's not really officially done.
Well, that's great.
Yeah, and I watched the college admission scandal from afar and just go, fuck, oh my God.
It's close call, huh?
Madness to watch that.
Well, it's madness because there's it's one of those things, because how it happens. You operate in the rare air of privilege, and you just go, this is what people are doing, so I'm going to do it.
I mean, I guess. Right? I mean, I guess. I mean, I would never dream of doing what these people are on wiretaps doing. I mean, look, my kids are really privileged. They're lucky. They went to great schools. I was able to pay for the schools. I was able to pay for tutors. Yeah. So they already have such a leg up. But my kids busted their ass.
And you made sure that they did that.
Oh, yeah. No, I was very early on very, very strict about academics. And it starts immediately.
Were you that way? You weren't that way.
I was good in school.
Yeah.
I liked school. I worked really hard. I was good in certain areas and not good in like math and all that stuff. But right. I was serious about school. I was.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but that's good. I mean, you turned out to be a good parent somehow. Thank God you got sober.
No, for sure. My kids laugh because they can't imagine me taking a drink, you know?
Oh, really?
They've never seen it.
No. What a gift that is.
I know.
Jesus.
You really
got out young. That's impressive. Yeah, I mean, it took me 10 years more than you.
And here's what you know. It takes what it takes.
No, I know.
It's like you can't do it for... And the irony is we think we did it for the girl. You mentioned the girl in your life. I mentioned my wife, Cheryl. But at the end of the day, the only reason we do it is for ourselves.
Yeah.
And you can't do it for your job.
Oh, yeah.
You can't do it for your court case. No, you can't do it for any of it.
No, you got to be ready to do it, and it's got to click in.
Yeah.
If it don't click in, it ain't going to click in.
Yeah.
No, I lost a girl. I made her horribly miserable. I just, I went right from drugs to just draining her of her life force. And she got out, and in retrospect, I can't blame her.
Amazing.
but I grabbed on, man.
Yeah,
I grabbed on.
You take what you need.
Yeah. So, all right. Now, how do you decide? I mean, you talk about, kind of having a you're the oldest guy, the most knowledgeable on the set. You've been doing this a long time. You know, you'll do TV, you'll do movies, you'll do whatever.
I won't do whatever, but I'll do whatever.
Where do you draw the line?
I will do whatever I feel is going to be an interesting experience,
uh-huh.
or where what I feel like I can give will be additive.
Okay. So do you turn down a lot?
A lot.
And is it usually small movies or just shitty parts or you don't know? It's just project to project.
Dude, I turned down Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah.
It can be a monstrous...
For an arc or a regular thing?
To play McDreamy.
Oh, really?
That's a minor... That probably cost me $70 million. Hey,
but you're
it's
not
just
worried.
Money.
You're not thinking about
but
that.
But you know what? But listen, at the end of the day, it was like... I watched it when it came out, and when they started calling the handsome doctor McDreamy, I was like, yeah, that's not for me.
Right.
Not for me.
Yeah. But the comedy thing, that was one of those things because you weren't really prone that way.
I was always a big comedy guy. It just, people didn't know. Like I can remember being 12 and 13 and watching the first seasons of Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
And then I would perform the sketches for my parents when they would wake up on Sunday mornings. So I was a comedy nerd from the get-go. I just had never had a chance to do any of it until I hosted the show, which was a dream come true.
And what was that coming off of? How'd you get the gig? You've done it a few times, right?
I've done it three times. I did it in 90 off for Bad Influence. And then...
Was that a hit movie?
No. Critics loved it, and the audience it was a little tiny release, terribly released.
Yeah. I remember loving the movie.
Yeah, it's a really good one. It's for sure one of my, if I had to pick two off the top of my head, it would be Bad Influence and About Last Night.
But so comedy though, it all started with the relationship with Lauren and Mike.
Yeah, with Lauren and Mike. And I remember working on Wednesdays, you go in with the writers on SNL and walking into Mike Myers' office, we'd never met. And him saying, do you want to do a Wayne's World sketch on the show or do you want to do Sprockets? And I was like, I hate Wayne's World. I think it's stupid. I want to do Sprockets.
Yeah.
Which we did. And it was really fun. And then the irony that we would end up in Wayne's World is funny.
So that's really what drives you, is you want to have a new experience and a good time.
Totally.
But West Wing, that was good. And that was,
it was
not
great.
Comedy, but that was really a community. That must have been an amazing experience.
That was
for years.
When I read that script, I mean, there are very few scripts that you read and just blow your doors off like that.
Yeah.
And also read a character where you go, I'm the only guy who can play this part.
And
which of course is not true, but that's what it feels like.
I felt that way about the wrestling show, so I'm glad that it didn't make it to you, that you were just an idea, because, you know.
But there are parts like that.
No, I know. I don't have the range that you do, obviously. So if the guy's kind of like me, I'm good.
Yeah. Listen, by the way, plenty of people made a great career in that gear.
Yeah. But you don't really. I mean, it's weird because you think, you know, I think I know you, but you do a lot of stuff that it's not really you. I mean, you can definitely not be you.
Oh, listen, and behind the candelabra,
that was crazy.
That's
dude.
Me at the far edges of my range.
That thing, I love that movie. I've watched that thing like 4 or 5 times.
Thank you.
You're great in it, and Michael Douglas.
It's amazing movie.
It's crazy.
Crazy.
Who are you talking to, Mumbles?
It's unbelievable. Oh my God, I look like my father. I look like my mother, and what? No, Nanette. He's unbelievable. Isn't it?
Damon was great, but your character was like inspired because it was almost like a David Lynchian character. Like, was that a real guy?
He's a real guy.
Plastic surgeon.
Yeah, real plastic surgeon who is notorious for giving one of the first big famous botched face jobs in L.A. There was a very well-known realtor in L.A. who notoriously had a horrific face job done. He's dead. He blew his brains out.
He did?
Yep. There are no real photos of him, so I imagined that character. What happened was I got this offer.
Yeah.
And this is what's great about this business. I don't know Steven Soderbergh. I love him.
Yeah.
Never met him. Never had a general meet, nothing.
Yeah.
Out of the blue, phone call, I want you to do this part in this movie. Great.
Yeah.
And I've been tracking the movie just as a fan.
Right.
Because the notion of the movie sounds so mental.
Yeah.
And so I sat there and I'm competitive.
Yeah.
And I come from ensembles. Outsiders was an ensemble. St. Elmo's Fire was an ensemble. West Wing was an ensemble. And the keys to ensemble is you better fucking plant your flag or you're going to get eaten alive.
Really?
Yes.
Is that true?
Fuck yeah. You need to be a team player.
Right.
But you also need to get your numbers.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Kind of.
You need to get your touches.
Yeah.
As they say. No, you're not a sports guy, but I'm giving you some sports vernacular.
Well, no, I like to know this because I was recently in an ensemble movie and I realized I had to figure out what my place was in it.
It's an orchestra and what are you going to play?
Right.
Are you going to, and by the way, sometimes you're going to play under. I'm just going to do a low bass riff.
Right.
You know, just be in the pocket
the
whole time.
Yeah.
Or
I understand these metaphors,
right?
Yeah.
Or you're like, you know what? I'm putting the squawk box on it, and I'm gonna blast it.
Yeah.
So I figure I got Michael Douglas, who's a genius.
Yeah.
Playing Liberace.
Yeah.
And Matt Damon, who's also one of the great actors.
Yeah.
In butt tight velour shorts and with frosting on his hair.
Yeah.
Like I got to bring my A game. So I concocted this character and this look.
Yeah.
And
you came up with that look?
100%. I called Soderbergh beforehand and I said, listen, I think the tone is pretty clear from reading the script, but I just want to ask you, I have an idea, but it's a really big swing.
Uh-huh.
Are you down for that? And he was like, oh, swing away.
Yeah.
I was like, great.
And you didn't even have to pitch him?
I just showed up like that.
With the hair?
Yep.
And
I had
you have weird teeth.
I had hair. I had teeth, and I also had they had taped my skin back, eyes and forehead and neck, so it looked like I had a bad facelift.
Right, and you seemed almost drugged out.
It was a little drugged out, and he looked very sort of metro. So I kind of wanted to cut against that because the other guys are so openly gay.
Yeah.
So I used the voice from the guy I used to do Men's Warehouse.
Oh,
remember the Men's Warehouse commercials?
Yeah, I kind of
the guy like, "I'm the you're gonna like the way you look."
Yeah.
Remember that guy?
Yeah.
So I just stole that voice. You're gonna like the way you look. So I thought it was funny to look like a woman.
Yeah.
Basically.
Right.
But to have that voice,
yeah.
I thought the California diet. You lose 20 pounds in 10 days.
And did you? Because. The movie's not really a comedy, but it's not.
It's hilarious.
It is. It does have that tone.
Yeah.
You know, there's definitely moments where, and that character was so like out there that you know it definitely provided that.
It also proved to me that the old adage, that it isn't about the size of the part. Because I, in all of the work that I've done in my career,
yeah,
for my peers, that part, 1,000,000,000% was the part.
Like, yeah.
In terms of, you know, you're walking down the street and Spike Lee runs across traffic to hug you or whatever.
It's, really?
It's around that part. Yeah, people lost their minds.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Because they'd never seen you do anything like that.
I honestly think people didn't think it was me until the credits.
Wow.
I'm pretty sure. And a lot of people didn't.
Yeah, that's great. It was definitely an inspired part. I'm having that experience with fucking, have you watched the new True Detective?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
With Dorf?
Yeah.
What the fuck? I know,
right?
I didn't even know it was him for half the first episode. I'm like, where'd this guy come
from?
Isn't
it great when you see somebody like in Star Is Born, when you see, the comic.
Dice.
Andrew Dice Clay.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he can act. Yeah.
Yeah, you're like, wait, listen, when people reinvent themselves, it's the best thing ever. And, you know, no matter who you are, you got to reinvent yourself like every decade. I swear to God you do.
So tell me more of these acting tips. Like, so in an ensemble, you've got to figure out how you're going to stand out.
You got to. I mean, finding that right nexus of being a team player, supporting your other actors, serving the story. This is not about scene stealing.
Yeah,
although it is. It's not about sandbagging your other people. You're building them up. You're there to support them, but you're bringing it.
But you don't want to be steamrolled.
You don't, dude. I don't want to sit there with Michael Douglas and Matt Damon and get my hat handed to me.
How would that happen? Has that happened to you where you're in a scene and you're like, I just got buried?
It happened. I remember it happening to me once. In class, and I did a scene with Cliff Robertson. Now, Cliff Robertson's got an Oscar.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
And
for playing Hef? What did he get the Oscar for?
Wasn't he great in that movie?
He's great.
Dude,
in movie.
That movie is the best.
Yeah, Star 80's quite a movie.
The best. Oh, my God.
Eric Roberts really was something.
The best.
Yeah, yeah.
One of my favorites. I could quote every line from that movie. I love that movie.
Yeah.
But no, he won it for Charlie, where he plays the guy who mentally regresses.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Older movie.
Based on the book Flowers for Algernon. And in class, I had to tell him that I forget what the scene even was, but he was hearing that his wife, my mother, was going to go into a mental institution or something, and he just wiped the floor with me.
Oh, yeah.
I just sat there with him and gone, oh, okay. So that's how it's done. I was 20. And I was like, okay, I'm not going to let that happen again.
And he wasn't even breaking a sweat or nothing.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. Those guys, like I talked to Jeff Daniels about it. He said, you got to, you know, those older dudes, those actors, the big actors, they have like, they know exactly what to do with their face.
100%. It's your face, your eyes. I had dinner with Michael Caine this year, who famously has a lot of great acting. His book, if you haven't read it,
yeah.
He's got great acting. His new book, Blowing the Doors Off,
yeah,
is all about this. It's amazing. And, you know, his thing is all about where you look in your other actor's eye.
Yeah.
Like, it's very broken down into the technique of it, which is a big part of it. Because
this is for film acting,
but,
yeah.
But there's also the same technique for theater. It's mm-hmm. just a different technique. But, you know, very few actors have the experience, the talent, and the technique.
Yeah.
And when you have that, you're a monster.
And you feel like yours is all tight.
Just look. What's the thing about 50,000 hours?
Sure.
Right? I'm way over that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm way over that.
I thought it was 10,000. Is it 50 now?
I think it might be 50.
So what's the plan, man? So are you gonna shoot the one-man show?
So I haven't... people have talked about it. I haven't decided yet. I mean, you know, maybe there'll be a residency in Vegas, which would be really fun.
Because you could just fly out there.
Just fly out and do it.
Yeah.
I love doing it. I mean,
what's the hotel you're doing at?
The first one I'm doing is Planet Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think I'm going to do Caesars after that.
So like a residency would be what, 3 nights a week?
Right.
I don't know.
I guess you can figure it out. Friday, two shows Friday, two shows Saturday.
Sure.
You know, and then I have a new limited series called Wild Bill. That I shot for ITV. That'll be probably on Hulu or Netflix.
The Western?
It is not a Western. I play an American law enforcement analytics specialist who takes the job nobody wants to run the Boston Lincolnshire Police Department. Boston Lincolnshire is in the middle of England, the home of Brexit.
Yeah.
And
do you do British? Are you American?
It's a fish out. I'm American. Oh, okay. It's a fish out of water crime drama, and it's awesome. I just finished doing it.
And you had fun doing that?
It's yeah, and it came out great.
And then, and what about movies? Any movies?
Let's see what's happening with. I have a movie on Netflix, a holiday movie coming out next Christmas, which is really fun. Shot entirely in Africa. It's really romantic.
Really?
And I am negotiating and likely to do a movie with the director who did Rudy and Hoosiers, two of my favorite sports movies.
Hoosiers, great.
Great. And it's the story of Carol Rosenblum, the who is one of the original owners of the NFL. And it's basically the story about the creation of the NFL.
Oh,
as,
really?
As told through his eyes.
Who's, and that's you.
And I'd be Carol Rosenblum, yeah.
And then, of course, Mental Samurai.
And then, the, as you call it, the arm. What do you? It's genius.
The arm.
You call it the arm show.
Yeah,
it's the arm show.
The giant arm.
It's the giant arm, dude. It's addicting.
Sure, people like they don't want to be. Yeah, you know, if you're just challenging them with questions, and there's an amusement park ride, it's great.
I mean, that's what I want.
Yeah, that's it's all anybody wants, Rob.
It's all anybody wants.
Thanks for talking, man.
That was great. Appreciate
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
That was Rob Lowe. The show is Mental Samurai on Fox. Tuesday nights on Fox. Also, go to WTFpod.com/tour for all those upcoming dates in the UK. I believe there's some tickets left for London, Birmingham, Salford, Dublin, but not many. So go there, WTFpod.com/tour for all the upcoming dates in San Diego, St. Louis, Madison, wherever. All right? All right, good. I'm going to get ready to perform. I might go get something to eat. All right? You want to buy a house? Huh? How about a house? Boomer lives!
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Moin, wir sind die Footballerei. Ich bin Kutsche.
Ich bin Flo.
Und ich bin Daniel.
Wir sind aber noch viele mehr. In der Footballerei gibt es American Football Freischnauze, überwiegend die NFL, in ganz vielen verschiedenen Formaten. Da ist für alle was dabei.
Das Frühstücksei zum Beispiel gibt es jeden Montag ab 5 Uhr als Podcast. In der Saison natürlich mit den ersten Reaktionen auf die Spiele des Wochenendes und in der Offseason versorgen wir dich hier mit allen frischen News aus dem NFL-Kosmos.
Dazu gibt es die bunte Welt der NFL in Kutsches Zirkus, hochspannende Kriminalfälle bei Hall of Crime und das Thema der Woche während der Saison in der Footballerei. Show.
Also, wenn dich American Football fasziniert, wirst du die große Auswahl in der Footballerei lieben. Wir freuen uns auf dich.